Sometimes you have to wonder, is anyone capable of violence? Is brutality bred in our bones? Enter the fierce people. That's what anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon calls the indigenous Yanomamo Indians of the Amazon. His 1968 book about them is one of the best-selling anthropology books of all time. But in the 45 years since he wrote the book, Chagnon has come to a stark conclusion, that the violence and brutality the Yanomamo are famous for is basic human nature. Now, in the anthropology world, that's incredibly controversial, and Chagnon's taken a lot of heat for it. When they talked together, Steve Paulson asked him to take us back to his first contact with the Yanomamo. He was traveling deep in the Amazon with a missionary when they were suddenly surrounded by a group of men with runny noses, all pointing arrows at him. Turned out they were just back from a fight.
The fight didn't happen in the village I was going to, but the people who lived in that village had gone to the club fight and fought with the men in the other village and got the women back. And the villages were about, you know, 4 or 5 hours apart from each other on foot. Anyway, they had this brutal club fight, and the people that they took the woman back from, on their parting enjoinders, said that next time we come to your village, we're going to shoot you and kill you. So when I walked into the village, they thought it was raiders from the other village coming there to get revenge. And that's why they met us with drawn arrows. And, of course, in the jungle, they didn't, well, yeah, we're expecting the anthropologist to get here any day now.
Did they know you were coming?
No.
So this was a total surprise.
Yeah, it was a complete surprise for
them. This white anthropologist would show up in their village. Yeah.
Anyway, after the dogs stopped yapping and were constrained by their owners, they recognized the missionary who was with me. He came in right behind me, and they were real happy to see him. And they chatted for a while, and then presently they went back to snorting their drugs.
Which, so that's what was causing the mucus pouring down their face?
Yeah, the drugs were a ground powder they mixed with ashes from a particular kind of wood, and then they put the substance in the end of a foot-long hollow tube made from a bamboo, and they would blow it up each other's noses with immense power.
Was this some sort of hallucinogen?
Yes, it was a hallucinogenic drug, and they use it almost every day to chant to their spirits and wage war with the spirits against their mortal enemies on the ground. And so they not only fight with bows and arrows, but they have their spirits fighting as well.
So this must have been a total shock to you.
It was. My enthusiasm for interviewing people and taking notes diminished in proportion to the number of times the brush was rattled to the outside and the men ran up with their drawn bows and arrows to see who was trying to get in.
So how did you communicate with them?
With great difficulty. At first they thought there was something defective about me because I didn't understand their language. And they just assumed that I was hard of hearing. So they began saying things louder to me until they were shouting, and finally they realized that this guy's a bobo. He can't understand it. A single thing we're saying, and so they just gave up on me. But before Barker left, I managed to get a list of phrases in the Yanomamo language translated into English that I could then build on, and that's how I learned the language. Little by little, I would substitute new words I learned into the phrases that Barker had given me, and by the end of about 4 or 5 months, I was able to conduct myself in a relatively efficient fashion, as long as there weren't any sophisticated issues involved. Like, you don't start translating myths of Indians in 6 months, despite what Margaret Mead says.
You had been, you still were at that point, a student in anthropology.
Yes, I was a graduate student in anthropology.
What were the biggest surprises to you?
Well, first of all, in all the readings that I had put under my belt in preparation for doing my field research, you'd read ethnographic reports on tribes of Indians that say the Amazon Basin. They have arrows. They have bows. They make pottery. They make their houses out of vines and thatch. They have warfare. They have cross-cousin marriage. Well, I mean, these neutral things like they have warfare. I mean, you would just, reading it in a book, you'd think, well, they have warfare, and we have warfare. Well, I hadn't realized what warfare in the flesh actually meant. I mean, these people, they were the last major multi-village tribe of Indians. There were close to 25,000 of them, but nobody knew that, who were still conducting warfare without being interfered with by either the government of Venezuela or the government of Brazil. Most of these people weren't even aware that they were living in some country that had a name like Venezuela.
Now, when you say they conducted warfare, there would, what, be wars between different villages?
Yeah, they fought mostly over women. If you asked a Yanomama, why did such and such a village split into two parts and one part move away at such and such a place, they'd say, women. We fought over women. That's why we split apart. We couldn't live with each other any longer.
When you say they fought over women, it's like one village would raid another village to abduct women?
No, it wasn't quite that simple. It was easier for them to visit a village, a group of men visit a smaller village coming from a larger village, and then take women with them on the way out when they were going home. And, of course, the men would want to get their women back.
Sure.
And they would henceforth and thereafter sneak up on them and raid them, waiting to get one of the men alone outside and shoot him full of arrows, and then flee and go home.
Was this common, this kind of thing?
Yes. One village that I was studying was raided 25 times in the first 17 months I was living there.
Wow.
It had a lot of enemies. It was a big village, but what happens is when you're a big village, you've got a lot of enemies, and if one of them attacks you, that's when all of the other 15 villages who are allied to the first village will jump in, because they know that even if it's a large village, they can't possibly retaliate against a group of dedicated men who are trying to get revenge on previous killings. And so their wars would go on and on and on. And
so there was a kind of a cycle of revenge then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Until one group would eventually move so far away that it would be impractical for raiders to, you know, walk 4 days to raid them, because they'd have to travel through territory that wasn't theirs, and that's dangerous.
Now, when I was reading your account of this, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, it was so different from our culture. But there's a piece of me that's thinking, they must see that, I mean, this is counterproductive in some way. I mean, you know, you raid another village, they raid back, and, you know, you kill one of theirs and they kill one of yours. And
well,
I mean, there's a kind of a futility to
this. History of Europe and the United States in the 20th century, I mean, it was kind of dumb for people to do what they did then. And people are not necessarily rational and logical when it comes to attacking other nations.
Is there sort of a, I don't know, an ethical, are there ethical rules about this kind of thing?
Well, it depends on what your definition of ethics is. There's a sense of fairness and fair play, and it's considered to be poor form to invite somebody to visit your village and then mercilessly fall on them and kill them. But they nevertheless do that. Hmm. It's like talking to an alcoholic who got sick and vomited and really hung over the next day, and somebody saying, well, you should learn your lesson. I bet you won't do that again. Well,
yeah. Now, part of the fascination of your story is because it would seem to get to one of the enduring mysteries that we have, which is, what were our ancestors like?
Well,
5,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago.
I'm still fighting that battle, because anthropology and most of the social sciences are divided on this deep philosophical issue about the nature of man and the state of nature. And because part of the history of anthropology has endorsed the noble savage idea that people in a state of nature are, you know, running through the forest with shining, glistening bodies, perfumed flowers in their hair, altruistically doing whatever they can to help their neighbors. Well, it's not that kind of world out there. And for the longest time, anthropology has denied the importance of biology and the evolution of the human organism, because they study culture. And elaborate attempts have been made throughout the history of anthropology to separate human beings from biology, because humans have souls and believe in spirits and things of that sort.
Now, I mean, this sounds like a Darwinian story.
It is.
You've been describing. I mean, it's if the wars are basically fought over women, over you know, access to sexual reproduction.
Right. I mean, they fight for reproductively useful or utilitarian goals, not just gold and diamonds, as some of my colleagues would say. They're fighting over women. Gold and diamonds, I can understand, but women, never. The thing that I brought to the attention of my colleagues was there is such a thing as human nature, and the evolved organism that we're studying, man, is a product of evolution from higher primates. And the dimensions of that effect on behavior of all primates is a natural history. And one of the most horrible crimes I committed was a publication in the journal Science, one of the most respected journals in the community of academics who are scientists. It includes biology, chemistry, physics, but also anthropology as a science. And one of the articles I published was about Yanomami warfare. And what I found after collecting all of these genealogies and demographic facts and statistics was that men who had killed people, enemies in other villages, had 2.5 times as many wives and 3 times as many children as men their own age who were not killers. And this was offensive to a lot of anthropologists, and many people have since that publication in 1988 attempted with ingenious different arguments to undo that argument.
Well, and it's striking that, I mean, you have very vocal admirers, including some of the biggest names in science.
Yeah, that's
Steven
true.
Pinker, E.O.
Right.
Wilson.
Right.
I mean, it's striking that a lot of them are either evolutionary psychologists or evolutionary biologists.
But they are all evolutionary biologists.
Right. But when you get to cultural anthropology, they tend not to like you.
No, they don't. But that's changing. I was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2012. A year later, which was just this spring, I was inducted into the National Academy of Sciences. And in a very public, dramatic statement from one of my former professors at the University of Michigan, Marshall Solins, who is now at the University of Chicago, resigned publicly and openly and made a big ceremony out of it because I had been elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He had been elected, you know, 20 years earlier. And the whole point was that he was very much opposed to evolutionary biology or the whole idea of a human nature that was anything other than a cultural nature, and he still is.
Napoleon Chagnon's latest book about the Yanomami Indians of the Amazon is called The Noble Savage. Steve Paulson talked with him.